Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Eugenio Duarte. I hope you enjoy the interview you're about to listen to. If you do, or if you have ideas for books you'd like to hear about on the show, let me know. Go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on contact to send me a message. And now on with the interview. Hi, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in Miami. Today, I'm speaking to Morgan Marietta, co-author along with David Barker of the book One Nation, Two Realities, Dueling Facts in American Democracy, published in 2019 by Oxford University Press. Morgan Marietta is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, where he studies the political consequences of belief. His prior books include The Politics of Sacred Rhetoric, Absolutist Appeals and Political Influence, as well as A Citizen's Guide to American Ideology, Conservatism, and Liberalism in Contemporary Politics. He and co-author David Barker write the Inconvenient Facts blog at Psychology Today, and he is currently writing about the new Supreme Court and the future of rights and the conjunction of dueling facts and constitutional law in a book called The Supreme Court of Facts. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
Our pleasure. So let's start by talking about the inspiration for this book.
I suppose it started in about 2010 when Dave and I started talking about this phenomenon. And I guess I should say that Dave and I go way back. We were just talking the other day about 20 years now that we've known each other. Back from when I was a graduate student, he was a beginning assistant professor. And around 2010, we started talking about this phenomenon that we were seeing, that people had these tremendously divided, polarized perceptions of facts. And it seemed to be a new kind of polarization. It wasn't just about ideology. It wasn't about culture or media, geography, wealth. It had seemed to have advanced to a new form of advanced polarization about reality itself. And we started talking about this more and more, what was going on. And we started collecting data on it in 2013. And then what happened that made it all much more interesting, I think, is Donald Trump. And what happened then is this tremendous conversation blew up around 2015, 2016 about alternative facts and the Trump campaign, and tremendous discussion of misinformation and the ability of fact checking. And one of the first points that we came to is that what the book tries to do is do a very comprehensive look at the causes of dueling fact perceptions, the consequences of them, the possible correctives of them. But one of our first points is that this is not really about Trump or the Trump administration. It started way before that. We're sure it's going to continue way beyond that. People who think that in a post-Trump world, that alternative facts, dueling fact perceptions are going to go away are going to be deeply disappointed. We think it's actually deeply entrenched. We're rather pessimistic about the future of it. And it's going to be a deep and long-term phenomenon. But that's how it started, was this long conversation that we've been having. We've been working on the book now for, I guess, about the past 6-7 years.
So let's go straight to, I guess, the core concept of the book, which you just named, and that is dueling fact perceptions. Now, what exactly does that mean? I mean, how can facts be dueling?
Yeah, this is actually, I think, one of the first and really important parts of the book. We use this framework of the causes, consequences, and correctives. And we think these are the three huge social science concepts, that what is causing something, what is that then causing, and can you do anything about this? But the fourth one really is about the concept, the concept itself. There's tremendous disagreement about what the concept is and what is really going on here. A lot of people are very uncomfortable of even using this discussion of perceptions of facts. They think that, oh, no, facts are just facts. There's just reality. There's truth and there's lies. Okay, that is not true. That is not right at all. People really misunderstand the idea that there is, of course, a reality out there. Dave and I are not people who deny reality, or we are not deconstructionists or postmodernists. Reality is there. The problem has always been for humans that we don't have a clear grasp of reality. We don't have this tremendous immediate access to knowing what the truth is. Going back to Plato's cave, we only have these indications of it. So the problem is that we don't have stable facts, which is to say, facts are not reality. Facts are a social attempt to approximate reality. And what that means is facts are the things that reflect the best available evidence, and they're endorsed by the authorities of society that give us a sense of this. But we always don't agree on this and know about these things. There are many, many politically important realities where the facts are not clear. They're much more blurry. A couple of good examples of this, they're the ones that are really more clear, like, say, climate change. But then you move to ones that are not clear at all, like, say, false convictions. There's this tremendous debate in our society about how rare or how common false convictions are. People who say that they know the truth of that, that is not clear at all that it's true. You take the national debt. Is the national debt this tremendous problem, or is it not? Listeners might know that among economists, this is deeply debated. There's a new strain of what's called modern monetary theory, this idea that maybe the debt actually isn't very real or significant at all. A lot of these things are not clear. The effects of the minimum wage is deeply debated. Effects of immigration are deeply debated. So the problem is that we don't have access to facts. A lot of people call this whole debate misinformation. And what they mean by misinformation or misperceptions is that they're already sure what the facts are. And the problem is that we have both legitimate differences in perceptions and then, of course, a broad range of illegitimate differences in perceptions. But in either case, they're hard to sort out which is which. What we know we have is tremendous differences in perception. And we didn't try to sort out in the book who was right and wrong on each one of these. There's about 10 different doing fact perceptions that we study. And we didn't try to sort it out. We're not the experts on those facts. We tried to become the experts on the perceptions of those facts, why people see them so differently, what is really driving it. And we came to the idea that we really shouldn't call them misperceptions, misinformation, because that's assuming you know which one is real. They are really dueling perceptions of the facts, or dueling fact perceptions. And that, I think, is the heart of the issue.
So, go ahead.
One more quick thing. I wanted to mention this one because I love it so much. People, when they talk about facts, they often quote the old John Adams line that facts are stubborn things in their assertion that they're only facts and lies. But people forget actually the context of that. They quote the first part of the line, facts are stubborn things. And whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. And that sounds like this dramatic statement. And they always forget the next sentence, which is, nor is the law less stable than the fact. If an assault was made to endanger their lives, the law is clear. They had a right to kill in their own defense. And what's going on here is Adams is the defense attorney in the Boston Massacre. He's defending the soldiers who are accused of this crime. And his statement that facts are stubborn things, what he's saying is that the stubborn fact is that these soldiers were attacked and defended themselves, and there was, in fact, no Boston Massacre. Now, that's the exact opposite fact of the one that I was taught as a kid and most Americans believe. Most Americans believe there was, in fact, a Boston Massacre and the British soldiers acted improperly. So there's a real question here of which is the fact and which is the alternative fact and which is which. The irony is the great statement that most people use to justify the idea that facts are obvious. The people who are saying it also think that the opposite fact that Adams is talking about is the obvious fact. And we often live in a situation where there are not obvious facts.
And with that said, I was hoping to go back to the example of climate change because it seems like that, and I think that you hint at this in the book, it seems like that's an area where one would expect to find hard facts, numbers and scientific indicators that the planet is getting warmer and that is having real consequences. So when we see that society is divided about whether climate change exists, how do you understand that? I mean, is it that people believe different facts, or is it that people are disputing what the facts are, or is it that they can agree to the facts but interpret them differently?
Climate change is the one that Dave and I started talking about, this whole project, around 2010. What was becoming really clear in the evidence, and there's a lot of fantastic empirical evidence and articles on this, that at the same time when all of the evidence of climate change, and especially global warming as a facet of climate change, when the evidence was becoming more and more clear, people were becoming more and more divided about it. And they were denying that evidence more and more as the evidence got larger and larger. And we kept saying around 2010, 2011, 2012, this is going to have to change. This is going to have to switch. A consensus is going to have to develop that is going to match the consensus of evidence. And then we realized that that was not going to happen. It still hasn't happened. I don't think it's actually going to happen. And this is why. That even though that is one of the ones that's very clear, this is one of the sort of the grandfathers of the great examples of dueling fact perceptions in the face of very clear evidence. The problem is that people think that they have very clear access to this. But the real truth is that people don't have personal access to this information. They have to rely on reports from scientists and universities, and especially media, which means that truth relies on trust. Access to facts relies on trust. You have to trust the messenger. And that, we realized, was the problem. People don't trust the source. They don't trust the media. They especially don't trust universities any longer, which is, we have a whole chapter on this that's really quite fascinating. And what that allows people to do is to fall back on the very deep psychology that is driving this. And that takes us to the causes of this. A great chunk of the book is not just about the consequences and the possible correctives. It's about the core cause of this. And we entered into a debate that's going on in political science and in psychology about what is the cause of dueling fact perceptions, what some people call partisan facts. And there's a large argument that it is about misdirection, that it's about misleading. So it's essentially about partisan leadership, that what people are doing is they are following party leaders, they're following media figures, say Hannity on Fox or Maddow on MSNBC. And that is the more optimistic view on this. If it's really just misinformation and people are being misled, then we can correct the misperceptions. And all you need to do is provide the accurate evidence. And what Dave and I really started thinking, and then when we studied this more and more, we did 5 years of surveys on this. From 2013 to 2017, we were collecting national data year after year, looking at this broad range of dueling fact perceptions and many other variables that we were looking at. And it turns out that The major drivers, the things that really predict what perception an individual will have, it's not their partisan identity and it's not their media consumption. It's actually their deeply held values. What people are doing is they are projecting their preferred values onto their perceived facts. And there's a whole process of how this happens. So there's many deep psychologies that people are selectively perceiving. They are choosing out of the broad range of facts we have, or of pieces of information. We have this fantastic amount of information, but very little trust. And in an environment where data bits are high and trust is low, you have no guide of which ones to take. So people just take the ones that suit their values, the ones that make their values look true and right and important, the ones that are grounded in their social connections. There's a scholar named Anna Kirkland who wrote about the vaccine debate. And vaccines are fascinating because, again, it's dueling fact perception. That's one that is actually half right and half left. It's actually not conservatives or liberals who think that vaccines cause autism. It's actually both. It's people who share certain values on either side of the debate. And one of her great lines from Vaccine Court, her book on this, is that you can never repeat too many times that scientific evidence does not have some mystical ability to change minds. It has to be trusted. And if it isn't trusted, people just reject it. They instead choose the perception that makes their values look important. And if the other side of it isn't just cognitive psychology, it's social psychology, that Kirkland's argument means that if you have a choice of being right or fitting in with your social group, the advantages of being correct about something like climate change or your perceptions of racism or false convictions or the national debt, it has very little payoff for you. But the payoff for being attached to your social group and not alienated from the people that you love and the people who support you, that has fantastic payoff. So people will choose the perception that matches their social group and matches their personal values way quicker than they will match the ones that alleged experts whom they do not trust say is real.
But going back to this question of trust then, isn't it the case that people will quote unquote trust those sources of information only who provide the kind of information that they want to hear?
Yes, I think that is very much true, that people will selectively perceive. And it's not the case that media consumption has nothing to do with it, or that partisan leadership has nothing to do with it. These do have effects. They are secondary to the core value effects. But it's definitely the case that people selectively attend to certain messages. The other thing they do that I wanted to mention, there's some deeper parts of the value projection that go into this selective perception. It's not just that they are all starting from the same place, starting from the same questions. You might think that everyone had the same question: is climate change real? And it turns out that that's not right, that people begin with different questions and therefore arrive at different answers, which means also, as you're suggesting, they go to different sources, they believe and trust different things. Dave and I call this intuitive epistemology. This is one of my favorite chapters. I think it's one of the most interesting pieces of psychology in the book. And we take this actually from Phil Tedlock, and we're great admirers of his work. And he suggested this some years ago, that people have different epistemological foundations, which is to say that how they seek knowledge is not the same. People start with different questions. And we tested this out in the context of dueling fact perceptions, that if you look at the habitual or intuitive questions that people ask, they are deeply connected to their value systems. If you know someone's values, for example, if they prefer individualism or collectivism, They think that individuals are essentially responsible for themselves, which is the conservative value that shapes a lot of American policy, or that we are collectively responsible for everyone, which is the liberal value that shapes those perceptions. People will then have different habitual questions that they ask when they look at the world. And if you are starting from different questions, you will reach different answers, which is to say that people's intuitive epistemology then frames their perceptions. And this, a lot of people have questioned this idea, given that values and facts are so different. We're accustomed to the fact-value dichotomy. First of all, there isn't a lot of difference psychologically between facts and values. Scholars break it out, but ordinary folk really don't. This is the bridge. This is how people take their values and project them onto their facts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But when you say that people start from different questions or with different questions, going back to, you know, the same example, climate change. If someone's not asking, is climate change real? What are the alternative questions from which they start?
They start questions like, is someone being harmed? Or is a sacred value being violated? Or are people being disloyal to us? And it's not that everyone is looking at climate change in a vacuum. It's the only thing they're looking at. They're looking at it in this whole web of their social concerns and their value concerns. So if you start from this perspective of care or harm, Jonathan Haidt has this fascinating way of looking at people's moral values. And care is one that is this tremendous predictor on the liberal side of how people see things. And if you start from that perspective, people start to think, oh, we should be worried about these harms. But if you start from a different perspective of are certain core values being violated or are people being disloyal to us, then you start to ask questions about the sources themselves. What people who are denying climate change are really saying is that they don't trust the universities who are saying this. And they think there is some misleading, misperception going on there. This is a fascinating phenomenon that university scholars haven't come to grips with, and we don't really know what to do with in the current day. But if you look at the data on trust in universities, it has gone down radically in the last 5 years among conservatives and Republicans. And this is a real problem because you need a trusted arbiter in society. Going back to our first point about facts relying on trust, if you don't have a trusted arbiter, and the university used to fill that role on both sides of the ideological divide, but if it doesn't, then you don't have to listen.
So, Morgan, are there any correctives for this?
That is the great question that many different scholars are working on now. Regardless of where people fall out on this causation debate, everyone wants to be able to bring us to consensus because the consequences of this are really deep, much more, I think, than a lot of people are recognizing, that it goes way beyond whether we can have consensus policy, that if we don't know where we are, as a society, we really can't understand where we're going. There are tremendous other consequences about whether we really can have meaningful deliberation, whether polarization is going to continue to cycle in this tremendous way. There's some experiments we did in the book I can talk about a bit later about the social effects of this, that when people recognize that other Americans have different perceptions of the world, they have these tremendously negative social reactions and don't want to work with them and don't want to talk to them. We understand that if you're a Democrat, someone else is a Republican. But if someone has completely different perceptions of the world than you do, you start to think very negative things about them. It has all sorts of other consequences that one might not recognize, that scandal becomes very difficult. There's this famous line that Donald Trump said during the campaign, that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't abandon him. And the thing about that, scandal, for it to be effective, requires that people on the opposing partisan side are also willing to admit that certain facts did occur. If facts are truly deeply divided in the way that we believe they are and that they're becoming, scandal becomes very, very difficult. Accusations of mental illness also, I predict, are going to rise tremendously, not just to politicians, but across the spectrum. One of the basic definitions of insanity is that you don't perceive the world accurately. So dueling fact perceptions lead to these perceptions of mental illness. Many of the listeners might know that the Goldwater Rule is falling apart, which is to say that psychiatrists, psychologists used to be banned by convention from diagnosing politicians from afar. But many working psychologists are now quite willing to say publicly that they think that the president is mentally ill. And this is somewhat unprecedented. And it has to do with these dueling fact perceptions. If you disagree about the world, you must be crazy. So tremendous political and social ramifications of this. So the great question is, can we do something about this? Can this be corrected? And Dave and I are deeply pessimistic about this. To give you the conclusion, we think that the most well-known or most suggested correctives are deeply ineffective, and we are cycling into greater and greater polarization of perceptions. We don't see a mechanism to pull us out of this. So we wanted to be much more optimistic, and a great part of the book is about empirically looking at possible correctives. And we unfortunately came to very negative views of it. And essentially this is why. There are two very large areas of correctives that people offer. And the first one is fact-checking, that maybe we can really put more effort into fact-checking and publicize it. And there's a lot of work on the epistemology of fact-checking and how this works. And we did some studies on this, and it turns out, along with some other people who are studying this, fact-checking is not very effective. In fact, it's not effective at all in changing people's perceptions of facts of this nature. It can have some important effects in discouraging politicians from lying as much. It can do some other positive things democratically, but it really does not change people's perceptions of facts. The people who should be reading fact checks do not read them. The people who do read them have many psychological mechanisms for dismissing them that have to do with trust, that have to do with their values and their social connections overriding them. And there's a fascinating thing going on that I wanted to point out, that if you talk to a lot of people who are cheerleaders of the fact-checking industry, they are deeply in denial about the lack of effectiveness of fact-checking. In other words, they are not applying their own standards of fact-checking to the facts about fact-checking. They're not being open and honest and recognizing the empirical evidence here that fact-checking is not working. And I think that's actually a demonstration of the thesis of the book. Fact-checkers have a deep social commitment and they have a deep value commitment to believe that fact-checking works, so therefore they believe that fact-checking works, but it doesn't. And the other one that's actually really disturbing for us and a lot of other scholars, a lot of other educators, is education is the other very broad idea that greater education really ought to pull us out of this. And this is the deeply disturbing finding from all of our studies, and this is, I think, some of the most important stuff in the book, that education does not work either. We actually can't educate our way out of this. The more formal education people have, the more divided they are about perceptions of facts across the board: climate change, racism, crime rates, vaccines, debt, immigration, minimum wage, all of these things. They don't move toward consensus. They move toward division. And there's another, maybe even bigger problem, that if you look at the connections between values and facts, that people are really projecting their beliefs onto their perceptions, the more education people have, the more strongly they do that. That if you look at these interactions, education doesn't lessen value projection. It deeply increases it. And what that seems is going on is that people aren't listening to the content of the education. They're gaining skills in their education. And then they take those skills, and these people with higher cognitive abilities are then using them to reach the conclusions that they want. So it turns out we can't fact check our way out of this, and we can't educate our way out of this, which means that we're not getting out of this.
Now, just to be clear on what you found from your study, sorry, when you say that higher education does not resolve these differences and the fact of dueling fact perceptions, is that assuming that higher education is distributed evenly across the board? Like, is that, like, if everybody were to be more educated, not just certain people in certain camps, you're saying even still, that would not bring people closer to a consensus if people on both sides of the aisle were more educated?
That's interesting. I mean, I don't want to extrapolate outside of the data set or about. We know that what we were able to look at and what scholars were able to really see is the effect of education on people. The sort of the hypothetical of different people. You mean if education were more egalitarian, if we were actually able to educate a broader number of people? But I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, a hidden question in my first question is part of the explanation for dueling fact perceptions difference in education?
You mean among liberals and conservatives, or you mean?
Sure.
This is another fascinating part of this, that we have a chapter on this. And again, this is something that it's fascinating when you really scratch into the evidence. You find a lot of things that you don't expect and that people don't necessarily want to hear. But there's a very popular argument that dueling fact perceptions or misinformation, misperceptions are asymmetric to ideology, which is to say that this is something that conservatives do, and it's not something that liberals do. And this is a reaction that we get a great deal of the time. Chris Mooney has written a lot about this and some other figures. And the problem is that when you start looking at the data on this, that's really not right. Other scholars have noted this also, that it's not asymmetric in the way that people assume, that it's only conservatives who are projecting their values into the facts and liberals are doing things honestly. It turns out that both sides do this in the data, that both are taking their values and projecting them into their facts. And this is not just both siderism of saying, oh, well, both sides do. The evidence really does indicate that that's the case. And there's something going on. There is an effect going on about conservatives not trusting universities. That is a conservative phenomenon, and which is causing them to reject a lot of university evidence. And it allows people on the right to say that, well, even with climate change, the evidence is dramatic, but it's all produced by liberal faculty, and therefore we can not take it seriously. But when there are cases where the university evidence does not support their values, liberals are just as quick to not listen to the evidence and substitute their values. It's true when it comes to vaccines. It's very much true when it comes to perceptions of gender. There's tremendous neurological evidence that has been developing over recent years that there are actually gender differences in different brain dynamics. And people on the left who have a different commitment will absolutely not pay attention to that evidence in the same way that conservatives don't pay attention to university evidence of things that don't fit their social connections and their value systems. There's also some really interesting ways in which there is asymmetry on the reverse side. One of the fascinating things that we found is that when you look at the social effects, if you look at the rejection and the refusal to work with people or deal with people who hold perceptions that are different from your own, it's actually liberals rather than conservatives who are more likely to ostracize people who dispute their perceptions of the world. So, and this is a fascinating one that we decided that one way to think about this is that the traditional argument that liberals are more tolerant, more accepting. Tolerance is for morality, but not for reality. That the liberal view of the liberal behavior is to tolerate moral differences, but not to necessarily tolerate perceptual differences. Toleration is for morality, not reality.
So let's talk about the consequences of all this, because in the opening of the book, you make a claim that really struck me. You claim that all of this leads to, quote, the degradation of civil society. And when I read that part, I thought, really, is it that serious?
Yeah, I'm afraid that we think it is. That a lot of other people have also talked about the clearly political problem that if we can't understand where we are, we really can't come to consensus on where we're going. But it's even deeper. It's even more problematic, I think, that when you look at the social side of it, and we did these really interesting experiments, which were a combination of looking at social media and dueling fact perceptions, that the idea is these are what we refer to as the Bob experiments, that there's this guy, Bob Stratford, and we asked people, if you are going to be working on a long-term project at your job, and your boss has told you that you have the option of working with this guy, Bob Stratford, and you've never met Bob before. So you do the obvious thing that people do these days is you look him up online and you look at his Twitter feed. And then in the experiment, we alternate Bob saying different things in his Bobbish way on his Twitter feed of suggesting that climate change is true or that it's false or that racism is very influential or that it no longer is. Or vaccines are real or they're not, or immigration is having these very negative economic consequences, or it's having these positive ones. And then asking people if they want to do things like work with Bob. And it turns out that there is massive rejection wholesale of Bob if he disputes people's perceptions of the world. And we think what this indicates is that there's going to be, that there already is, and there's going to be more of this spiraling polarization, that it is infecting not just politics and discussion, but social relations and the tremendous polarization of a bubble effect. And then it goes back to some of the things that I mentioned before, that scandal becomes quite impossible. Perceptions of events. We did these some really interesting looks at some recent events. You could think of the Jussie Smollett case. Why did people have such tremendously different perceptions of what happened there? And many people were unwilling to readjust their beliefs when new evidence came out. We did a couple of looks at the Trayvon Martin shooting of what was causing, and that was actually a tremendously divided perception after the trial and before of what happened there. And it turns out that partisanship plays a role, media consumption plays a role, but the much larger role is people's core values, that they're allowing their values to determine their perceptions. And if we can't agree on events and we can't agree on things like who our enemies are, this is actually going to be a tremendous problem, I think, in the future, dueling fact perceptions. Is Russia our enemy or not? Is China our enemy or not in certain ways? If we can't agree on these things, In the Cold War, we had a broad agreement on who our enemy was. We disagreed about how to handle it, but much of our core perceptions were the same. I also think we're heading to a massive debate about socialism. I think this is on the horizon about the facts of it, not one's idea of just the values of individualism, collectivism, but the facts of history and reality. Does socialism lead to positive outcomes? Does it lead to very negative outcomes? And we're about to enter into, I think, a long-term, deeply divided factual debate about that. And I think we are leading into an era of increasing division driven by facts and not just by partisanship and values.
So we're almost out of time, Morgan, but before we go, tell us about your next book, The Supreme Court of Facts.
All right, right. This is actually a combination of some interest in the Supreme Court and an extension of this research that Dave and I have been doing. One of the contradictions of my life is that I do both work in political psychology and in the Supreme Court. And I think they're the same thing, but no one else does. But I think they're the same thing because it's about belief systems. It's about the political consequences of belief. And to understand American politics, you have to understand value perceptions or values. You have to understand fact perceptions, ideologies. The Supreme Court has a very strong set of belief systems that are just more esoteric and they're more legal. But once you understand them, you can really understand what is going on there. But the new book is called The Supreme Court of Facts, and I'm working with Tyler Farley, who was a student at UMass Lowell, and we've written a couple things on this, Journal of Law and Courts. The Supreme Court is taking an increasing role in these arbitrations of facts in our society. And there's an old thesis that the Supreme Court takes up a lot of the problems in society that we can't solve. And that seems to be happening in the factual realm, that what's going on is the Supreme Court is one of the few remaining trusted arbiters in our society, and increasingly we're turning to the court to decide facts of what is true and not true. One of the recent interesting debates at the Supreme Court was about the nature of racism. And listeners who are familiar with the recent debate about the Voting Rights Act, the question that came to the court is whether racism is still powerful in persuading, in dissuading, in blocking voting in the South. And that's not a constitutional question. That's not about constitutional principle or theory. That's a question of reality. Either racism is still blocking Black voting in the South, or it is not. And PolitiFact had this fascinating check of the Chief Justice, John Roberts, in some of his comments in the oral arguments of how he was framing how you would know that question. How you would know the empirical evidence of whether racism is still powerful or not powerful. And this is the conjunction of what the Supreme Court does and what PolitiFact does. Who gets to be the arbiter? Is it PolitiFact? Is it factcheck.org? Is it Snopes? Is it universities? Is it now the Supreme Court? And the answer, we think, is increasingly it's going to be the Supreme Court. And that's going to have tremendous political ramifications, and it's going to have tremendous ramifications about how the Supreme Court operates.
So before we go, remind our listeners the name of your blog and how they find it.
Right, right. After One Nation, Two Realities came out, Psychology Today, the magazine, they have this tremendous blog system of a lot of different interesting people. It's called Inconvenient Facts, and this is a line that we use in One Nation, Two Realities. It comes from the old Max Weber line in Politics as a Society, that the role of a teacher is to explain inconvenient facts, facts that are inconvenient for people's partisan perceptions. George Orwell used that line also. And the idea of the Inconvenient Facts blog is that we have short pieces describing different facets of what we've done in the book and applying it to different events, we started talking about the Mueller report and how the Mueller report, people's reactions to it, listeners know that there's tremendous factual disagreement about what even a document says. What does the Mueller report actually say? And the reason that we're so divided is everything that we've just been talking about. And the Mueller report is both a it's a facet of the dueling facts phenomenon, but we were saying the other day at the blog that it's also causing more of it. It's leading to more of these divided fact perceptions, because what we thought was going to be a trusted arbiter, Robert Mueller, turned out to not give an answer. And if even the trusted prosecutor, who's deeply experienced and knowledgeable about things, if Bob Mueller can't come to a clear answer about collusion, and pardon me, he can't come to a clear answer about obstruction, then normal people are not going to be able to do that. And they're just going to project their values into their perceptions. Inconvenient Facts at Psychology Today will be continuing with a weekly blog post.
And people should make sure to check out, like I said, your next book, The Supreme Court of Facts. And they should check out the book that we talked about today, which is called, again, One Nation, Two Realities, Dueling Facts in American Democracy. Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.